Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trbukie
and Tomasz Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation.
Welcome to a new episode of the Talking About Platforms podcast. My name is Philip Meyer, and today I have with me my regular co-host, Daniel Trbukie. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Philip. Hi, everyone.
And we have with us Maria Petrik. She's an assistant professor of information systems and operations management at the George Mason University. And her research interests span across information systems and finance, management, organization science, and she's focusing particularly on the economics of blockchain. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Philip. Hi, Daniel. Thank you for having me today.
Thanks for being here with us. I would use our usual question to kick off the episode. You know, the podcast is titled Talking About Platforms. We do welcome people talking about platforms, even though we know that we're not always talking about the same thing when we say the word platform. So the first question is twofold. Is first of all, what do you mean by platform? What's a platform to you? And if you want to share with us something a bit more personal, how you end up studying platforms.
Yeah, thank you very much, Daniel, for asking. So in my definition to the platform business model, I'll be very, I would say, mechanistic, in a sense that for me, it's a business model type, and that creates the infrastructural opportunities for other agents, companies, individuals, users, to use these infrastructural opportunities and to create some new value. So per se, the firm creates value by providing the infrastructure and kind of like the foundational tools for other agents, economic agents, to create the derivative value and pretty much create the economy around the platform.
I think this is one of the most information system perspective we are having here on the podcast. And you'd like to add something on how you got there. So what brought you here in a way?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the most obvious answer, I think, is that how not to get here if everyone, and I would say like without overgeneralization, a lot of scholars actually are studying this novel platform. And the reality is such that you look around in the business environment and more companies, they either turn to being the business platforms or are being established as business platforms. And so in some sense, this model proved its efficiency for big players, as we know, like Airbnb, Ubers of the world, etc. And a lot of firms follow this model of inverting their firm because obviously it has certain benefits when just focusing on creating these foundational opportunities for other agents rather than managing the whole pipeline model of the production. So in some essence, it was pretty natural that at some point my interest diverted into this direction, and it's big, it's visible topic. So I think that it is my duty as a scholar to also be aware of it and also get interested in some nuances of this business model.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing. 1 or 2 weeks ago, because you mentioned the inverted firm, we talked to Jeff Parker, who I think he and Masha van Alstyne basically introduced this, at least this term of the inverted firm. And also we also talked a bit about the platform revolution and how Jeff would rewrite this piece of work today. And one of the technical developments that he would include, besides, of course, artificial intelligence, putting more attention to artificial intelligence, was also blockchain and the whole topic of decentralized platforms. Now I know that this is also a core part of your work. So how did you get interested in not just looking at platforms that are coordinated by like a single focal firm, but more on this distributed angle, which I don't know, what's your perspective on that? But I don't know the origin of this movement, but I would assume it was not driven by individual firms, but rather a broader technical community that started to implement the technical means to make decentralized platforms work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you just said, it's kind of like the dominating ethos in this industry, at least publicly known, that this is a movement kind of like against the centralization, in particular like of financial transactional systems, and kind of like the whole idea of decentralization, it's quite coherent with the idea of this open source software that I'm also doing research on. So it kind of like came along, these two interests came along. But to be more specific, I got into the topic as a researcher in about around 2017. That's about the time when I started my PhD program. And I've heard about blockchain and like probably as everyone else started learning from the Bitcoin perspective. So it was something new that everyone, not everyone, very, very few people in my circle were talking about. But then I found the community on campus in Florida, and where a lot of people from across the disciplines were talking about this new technology, and also like from the financial perspective, the cryptocurrencies phenomenon. And there were investors, there were engineers, computer engineers, systems engineers. And so I just like picked up it topic by topic. My entry was more from the, I would say, technical perspective. Well, information systems affiliation, it dictates my kind of like also focus, like where my attention goes. But in the end of the day, I think at this particular moment, it's much more than just technology. It's like the whole movement, the whole philosophy, if you wish to say. But yeah, just finalizing my answer, I'd say like I just got in and just stuck around for until now.
Fascinating. I'm wondering if you, or when you joined the blockchain and crypto sphere, what were the, from your perspective, the research gaps, if you can even say so? What was, from your like research scientific perspective, missing? And what did you get interested in regarding research gaps or areas of research to dive into from your information systems perspective?
Right. That's a good question. So I think at the moment when I started to like looking into the technology itself, and I was already like doing research, it was so new at that point from perspective of the technology application and the research perspective, that in fact, it was not a question of looking for gaps in something that has been already established, but it's rather has been like that very primal initial question, understanding, okay, what is it and what's new about it? So I guess that a lot of early researchers, and I would say still we are very early in both applications. We haven't seen the full potential of the applications, and we haven't seen the full rethinking or like the full conceptualization of what it is. But I have to admit that right now the field is much richer and much more understanding is where is it going to move next forward. So I guess that at the very beginning, the key question was like what it is and how do we think about it? What is it? What is this technology will bring? What changes it will bring to existing business models? Everything, all ideas evolved around this concept of decentralization. How is it going to manifest from the business perspective? But it was very too early, I would say. And I think important factor in this progression in understanding of what blockchain is and how it affects platform business models, like other interactions, is the evolution of applications. Because if you remember way back in the day, there was like Bitcoin from 2009 to 2013. Then in 2013, more cryptocurrencies started appearing. But still, it was pretty much major, like most visible application of cryptocurrencies, which were probably like very minor asset group that people were paying attention and like putting their capital in. And there was a lot of other negativity around that context because of all accusations of cryptocurrencies being the money laundering instrument, the dark market, illicit finance instrument. So for a longer time, I would say like maybe until the 20s, 2020, 2021, that was the dominating ethos. There were enthusiasts, but there was a large group of very polarized people who were like against its applications and actually like didn't believe in research too.
Well, in the way in which we are approaching platform studies, we often take the perspective of established firms that are seeing platform models emerging. And I was wondering if you ever done something similar coming from the decentralization world or the blockchain technology. So have you got any piece of evidence on how established firms, not necessarily born with a platform model, are approaching this type of tech trend or this type of ethos, as you were saying?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're asking if like the more traditional firms, mm-hmm. how they are approaching. Yeah, from my personal perspective, I think a lot of, well, it depends on like what companies are we talking to and in a sense, like which sector are we talking to. So some companies, they use kind of like this technology aspect, technology benefit to make the processes more efficient. And the most obvious example here are like the biggest stablecoin companies like Circle, Tether, etc. So they basically took the fundamental technology of blockchain, which is neutral pretty much, right? It's just zeros and ones. And they pretty much made a business case that where the payment rails based on blockchain are much more efficient and cheaper than payment rails on the existing like banking system, right? Because of like all these inefficiencies and frictions that are existent in the banking system. With blockchain, it's 24/7, it's international, it's lower commission rates. And that's pretty much was the biggest advantage and is the biggest advantage of the firms. They just utilized the technology in a very suitable and efficient way. But then when it comes to this whole ethos, like a philosophy of decentralization, then we see a lot of other players from other industries chiming in. And the most prominent to me, because I'm a little interested also like in retail, like apparel retail, just in general retail. So what I've seen that people wanted to and still want to experiment with all these Web3 thing marketing-wise. At some point, well, we've seen several hype cycles around blockchain and crypto in general. Then there were like NFT hype cycle. So people are like Starbucks, Nike, are experimenting with the Web3 artifacts. And as I see it, and pretty much it's not a secret also from their perspective, it's mostly for enhancing loyalty and kind of like engaging with their communities. So it's a instrument for community engagement because a lot of people are believers, I would say. And it's basically just alignment in their philosophies with their customers. But in that use case, I don't see really, it's not really about technology. It's about, it can be done in the sense that it can be done with any other centralized feature like 3D or augmented reality. It doesn't have to be blockchain marketed, but it just is because of this kind of like affiliation with the customer perceptions.
My perception as well is that established firms in many cases do actually follow the trend in a way to do things that, practically speaking, were possible even without that tech trend, but in a way to actually follow what's going on. You tend to invest much more than you could in a way to be there. But my perception is that in many cases, you actually leave behind the real potentiality of that trend or of that technology that's entering this kind of technology washing that is not bringing value in either direction of the discussion, neither for the firm, neither for the trend itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would also add that I clearly see that there are firms who want to be affiliated with blockchain, but they don't really need it for the purposes that they use. There are firms that want to be with blockchain and they actually try to use the potential, like real potential of this decentralization and kind of like, I would say decentralization of value capture, but they are not there yet. And then there are firms, like very few examples that I can clearly think that, yes, they kind of like, they got it. They used this technology or either aspect of either decentralization as like a social phenomenon or as a blockchain, just like model of for payments from technological perspective, but they really got it. They captured some important feature of this technology.
One factor that I have been thinking about and also talking about with other guests on the cast is the claim that going into a decentralized network versus becoming dependent from a centralized platform owner gives you as a complementor more quote unquote power. So you get less dependent, or you don't get dependent from a centralized owner. But on the other hand, because you make a technological infrastructure decision, you get dependent on the technological infrastructure. So the decision to adopt, for example, Ethereum or Solana as a layer one technology to build your application is, in my understanding, extremely important. So if you're a developer for an application, you want to use a decentralized technology, you have to assess what technological stack is the right stack for me. And from a perspective of someone who wants to build an application or adopt such a technology, we can, of course, think about what are the capabilities of these technological layers. But I know that you did a lot of research on the open source community that feeds and builds the technological layer, because these open source communities are, in my understanding, the replacements for, if you want to say so, like the focal firm that, in the case of a Google, an Amazon, or an Apple, basically from a central position, builds the technological layer. So if I want to assess the, let's say, ecosystem or community health of a particular blockchain community, how would I do it? Like, as a company, from a company perspective, how can I assess or guide my decision to adopt layer A or layer B going beyond the pure like technological factors? Is there something that comes to mind?
I think, and that's where my attention is focused right now in the open source branch of my research, is that I'm basically trying to understand, in this whole world of like the freemium model with the open source, how can we actually capture the value of all this open source? That's like pretty much my intention with the publication that you're referring to, about the reading the signals from the open source community development to evaluate the valuation of cryptocurrencies. And basically, way back in the day, there was this ethos, again, around cryptocurrencies when they just started to appearing, that people were talking about in the publics, in on forums. If you want to assess the value of the cryptocurrency, you have to go into and look into their development. Luckily that a bunch of these cryptocurrencies, I would say the dominating majority, we estimated at some point that around 66% of all open source, of all cryptocurrencies have open source code on GitHub. And basically what I'm saying, luckily that this information is easily observable, accessible to everyone. Everyone can go and look the stats on the GitHub website or on the GitHub account of the organization. So that was initial motivation for this study, that the pretty much anecdotal evidence from how the developers who were early adopters of the cryptocurrencies were assessing the valuation. And actually, it addresses the very important problem that still persists in this space, that because of this token funding model, we don't have really an efficient model to evaluate the market value of these enterprises. Because in traditional finance, we have like a cash flow that is, you know, based on some like real tangible assets that generate the cash flow. And so we can pretty much extrapolate and estimate how much the company is worth right now based on its cash generating ability. But with the token model, and especially that it has a lot to do with the network effects, we don't really have such well-shaped model of evaluation. So with that being said, because we don't know what to evaluate and how, we don't really require any information disclosure rules. So even now, a lot of the crypto and blockchain companies that are like natively crypto, you know, not adopters of technology that we talked before, like retail sector, for example, like a new generation of companies that were like crypto, blockchain native, I would call them like that. We don't really have any standard for information disclosure. And so my point of view is that since open source activity is so predominant in this sector, because majority of these tokens, they are, or even not even tokens, like wallets, dApps, they are open sourced. And we can observe this information. So why don't we just look at something that is available across all the companies to give us at least some basis for comparison.
What's the motivation of developers going into a crypto project? Or is this solving their own problem, or is it building a business?
I'm glad you asked. And one of my recent working papers actually looks at this aspect, the evolution of motivations a little bit in detail. But back to your question. So initially, as we know, the open source on its own is, as a movement, has appeared as, again, based on this ethos of let's create something that will be alternative to the commercial software and open source, like in a sense, like Libre, available to everyone. Everyone can contribute. And then we have like the whole stream of studies that investigate the motivations of developers. Why do they actually contribute? And a lot of it goes down into intrinsic motivations, that people want to self-actualize. They want to feel this, have this feeling of contribution, commitment to some community or like some product. So it's basically a lot of intrinsic motivations comes in place. But there also is like extrinsic motivations, even in the early studies from 2003, 2005, Lacani and Wolf, they do the survey-based analysis. And there are some career objectives, if to speak roughly, because it's open source, everyone can see your contribution, so you can build a reputation. And then later on, like outside of open source platform, one can monetize, or even sometimes inside in the open source platform. So when we go down into looking why people contribute to blockchain projects specifically, there is another interesting study from early 2020s that specifically asks the blockchain developers, why they contribute. And the major factor is, again, goes down to that intrinsic motivation of it's very intellectually stimulating, because there are a lot of very interesting, complex cryptographic problems. Not only cryptographic, but like a lot of cryptographic problems are there that people are just like to solve. So it's again goes down to that intrinsic motivation, self-actualization, personal growth, etc. But you also asked about whether people do it for their own benefit. And I think the today answer, at least there is an evidence for me that today's answer will be changing more to yes, there is a group of developers who do that as a professional activity. They get paid. So what we did, we kind of like explored a cohort of open source projects and looked at what is their organizational structure and what is their, where do they receive funding from? And it appears that around 50% of our like cohort are public companies or private companies, like that earn income from selling product or service. They just have their code open. They have the presence on open source platforms. And obviously in such cases, they have employed developers that just would do work for them. And even the larger projects, as we know, like all large L1s that are governed by nonprofit foundations, they also have affiliated developers that receive remuneration. They list the workplace in these foundations on their LinkedIn profiles. So I think right now we are evolved to the like more institutionalization in the sector. It became a professional activity being a blockchain developer. And there are more extrinsic motivations, like monetary motivations, to contribute to the sector, definitely.
I see some interesting parallels in or with the project I have been doing, which is about the history of web mapping. So geospatial data and basically geospatial applications. So starting in the 1960s, going through the 1980s, and then 2000s with the launch of Google Maps and Google Earth, really came to a wide adoption of digital maps. And then also 2007 with the iPhone mobile mapping. But in the early days, it was a lot driven by a technological push. People were just extremely enthusiastic about building applications that could utilize technological innovations like GPS and kind of make it happen. Like you said, intellectually stimulating. I think this is also what the motivation of the like driving this technological shift was. And also it has been extremely dependent on open source technology. There are some protocols that basically run like almost all of the mapping that you have on your phone that is still like open source protocols that are supported sometimes from like a handful of people. And if they would stop it, the whole like mapping community might have an issue. Another big driver of and supporter of this early movement was governmental actors. I think this is something that we don't see so much in the crypto community, or have not seen so much. And right now, supporting the open source community, if we dive into the mapping business or industry, they're the same companies that also run the current AI development. So it's Amazon, it's Google, it's Microsoft, it's Apple, not so much, but also, so it's big tech. Big tech funding the open source development in mapping. You said that there's also institutional funding in the open source community in blockchain. Is it the same companies? And if so, do you see like a danger in this initial, like achieving this initial goal of getting independent of the centralized big platforms, but while these centralized big platforms are the same that then also fund the counter movement and could like decide to stop the funding of, of the communities, or are they more independent because more and more it's a sustainable industry growing around this?
So regarding the blockchain landscape in open source, I think like from our analysis, we don't see that there is a traditional big techs like Google, Amazon, etc., that are widely represented in the open source, in the blockchain sector of open source, because there are own big players. Like Ethereum Foundation is a big player, and other L1 foundations are big players in this space too. So in that sense, no, it's not the traditional big tech, but it also shows that there is a domination of a larger companies. And I'm purely speaking here from the empirical evidence perspective that we see how many projects are being sponsored by the larger entities through the grant programs. In some sense, in this sector, there are their own big players. So leading with that thought, I think that we see the tendency to centralization not to be like so harsh, maybe in calling it centralization of decentralized sector, but just saying that there are leaders. Definitely there are leaders who have a larger market share in this space, for sure. And then to your second question that I was able to, part of the question that I was able to think about. So what you're saying about the development of the mapping technology, it actually falls very nicely into this framework, open innovation, right, that von Hippel describes in a lot of his works, that we should distinguish between like categories of the free innovation. It's a user innovation, and it's also an open innovation by the larger corporate entities. So user innovation is the one that is derived from a personal need. Kind of like in his book, he brings a lot of examples of medical devices that were developed by either parents, but someone who is deeply concerned with certain diseases that probably damage the health of their children. And they come up with these medical devices and put them open source because they want other people to use it for a better good, right? So it's a user-driven innovation. And there, I agree that there are a lot of intrinsic motivations. But then when we look in the other type of the this free innovation is the open, it's just open innovation, right? So it's a public good. Yes, it's not paid for. But then how companies use it is through complementarity to their main services. And that's pretty much their business model, because they can indirectly derive value from having an open innovation, publicly available. They can attract talent like this, and these open products also complement their paid services. So it's like creating larger value for the users attracts more users. So in some sense, that's the business model. And in blockchain sector, we also see that this model is being adopted as well. There are companies that branch off into open source because they're motivated, especially like as a established their nonprofit foundation that governs, for example, the layer one technology. And the idea behind it is that by making their L1 open source, they kind of like make increase the adoption, because if they were to govern this technology as a private company, then it would create more competitive tensions with the competitors in the space. And also users would be looking at it as something that is proprietary owned, and they would be then considering it from the market perspective rather than, oh, this is like an open tool, so I'm going to consider it not only from like market perspective, like comparing product A to product B, but I'm going to see how useful it is to me, or like how prospective it is to me, whether I want to contribute to it to develop it better. So there are those motivations in the blockchain sector too, which are pretty much same thing as like why Google opens their TensorFlow, like, right, is open source, why Facebook opens their Llama model. Same motivations here.
Well, I would jump on this with a bit of provocative question. So when you talked about the centralization of the decentralization models, because I have two feelings regarding what you were discussing that I would be interested to know your opinion about. You mentioned a lot the work by Fonny Hippel, and you talk about user engagement and user involvement and open source movement. And you talked about the balance between intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, which actually goes back, in my opinion, to some of the fundings that emerged 20 years ago or so in the open source community without talking about blockchain. So the fact that there were people contributing to these digital spaces for whatever reasons, for gratitude, for sense of challenge or whatever it is, and then evolving towards more extrinsic drivers, the more it grows. Now, I think Philip will start smiling, but the other side of this reasoning goes back to our once upon a time guest and then always mentioned back, Vili Leonvirta, who published a book that is titled Cloud Empire, that talks about how big platforms are somehow taking the role of governments and states in some social decisions. Now, we're not entering in that type of discussion unless you'd like to, but one of the main messages of his book is related to the fact that many of the big platforms that we see today actually started with a quite strong positive goal of sharing, of building something done by many people, of giving opportunities to, you know, certain stakeholders or in certain situations. But all of them growing after a certain threshold kind of found themselves almost going against their initial view because the scale they reached was not manageable with the same ethos they had at the very beginning. So I was wondering, what's the difference, in your opinion, with the blockchain movement? On the one hand, we still have this positive outcome of intrinsic and extrinsic motivation of people willing to contribute. On the other, it seems that the scale is already bringing to certain kind of centralization in something that was born to be decentralized. So I was wondering, what's your take there?
I absolutely agree with this observation because that's, unfortunately, to me, I think it's how the reality is, that after a certain level, and I think personally that this might be somehow related to coordination problem and like aggregation of the preferences problem, that it is after a certain level of scale, it becomes just very hard to aggregate the preferences of so many people. So there should be some aggregation being made. And with that aggregation, probably, like, you know, some central player, like main decision maker, gets the higher weight of the vote. And that's what we pretty much, I think, refer as a centralization, when the bigger entity has a larger power of decision making. So now your question is about what is changing with the blockchain. And that's a very interesting question. And that's where my thinking is right now, what I like to think about. And this is a hypothesis that we're trying to test right now, that blockchain also introduced this concept of the tokenization. And pretty much it's, we are now can digitize all transactions, all exchanges, and we have I'll call it monetary instrument, but some instrument of like value that we can now exchange as a payment for these transactions. So I think the presence of this token may have, in a sense, it does not maybe change completely, like this split between intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, maybe like this share will shift, but it makes this environment more institutionalized, in a sense that now, even if you contribute voluntarily to like the project because you believe in it, there might be an incentive system there that would reward you for your work. So it's already set up upfront. And I'm not saying that it's now set up upfront, but we see the grassroots of it. And I'll give you an example. The airdrops became a very important, very popular element lately in incentivizing the engagement with the blockchain projects, DApps and stuff. But what's interesting, a lot of L1, I would say like L2s, they also practice the airdrops with their development community. And it's still very hectic and sporadic to call it like a common strategy across multiple projects. But what they do essentially, they say, well, you've contributed to our community, like you've developed code, you've made like commits, pull requests, whatever, before, like in retrospective, we will assess your effort and we will reward you for this effort with our token. So this is pretty novel phenomenon. It, of course, creates a lot of, there are a lot of controversial thoughts about this, like who is getting rewarded and for what, of course. But as a mechanism for engagement and also for rewarding developers and kind of like pretty much, I don't know, assigning value to these quote unquote voluntary contributions, I think it may be something new that we haven't seen before.
I think it summarizes pretty well. On the one hand, the advantages, on the other hand, kind of a dilemma in like decentralized infrastructures, which is the algorithmic governance, which on the one hand is an advantage with regards to it's hard to change. That's why people trust in the system and want to use it and build on top of it, because it's hard to change. But when the system scales and new market mechanisms that you did not predict it in the beginning, and maybe then change, let's say, the outcome of a certain incentive that is encoded in the system's governance, turns out to be a negative outcome, it's still hard to change, right? This is, I think, exactly what these centralized platforms, for example, Billy mentions the case of eBay, that started without using individual identities, but then figured it is important to have individual identities because people only trust others in trading. And it's also, you can only enforce like a payment, for example, if you have the individual identity. And then they were quick to change the policies and the governance of the platform to make it mandatory to introduce it, and introduce a means to ensure that people have to use individual real identities. In a crypto project, there has to be a lot of more thought in the beginning. Or I think that's what I see. That's then encoded, and then because later on, especially the more decentralized, quote unquote, it gets, the more decentralized the ownership gets, I think the harder it gets to adapt to changing market dynamics when a system scales.
Reflecting on your thought very quickly, I completely agree. And I think what's the implication of this kind of like trade-off is that we actually, what we see sometimes, that the idea of full algorithmic, like code is law and we cannot change it, like immutability, the idea of immutability is not very practical one, because of how flexible is the environment of those who interact with this immutable system. And we cannot predict every single scenario, but in certain cases, we also cannot just be rigid to the changes that are required by the agents who interact with this system. right? So I guess that's pretty much the not justifies, but kind of like determines why we see certain, even certain elements of this centralized entity authority that makes changes, such as dictates the next fork of Ethereum, or like switched from POW to POS, right? That's a big decision. Yes, there are like voting mechanism, but still it's like not all the users are voting, and it's not like that everyone's vote is being satisfied with that. There is some consensus that is reached by the majority of voters about this big change. So in that sense, I think this is just an illustration of we need flexibility. Everything cannot be just purely rigid and encoded and immutable. And to switch sometimes between the modes of to adjust to this flexibility, to switch, to change this immutability, we need someone who will make this decision and take the responsibility. And typically collective responsibility is responsible is no one, right?
Yeah, so classic.
Less incentives to make such a big decision if it's dispersed.
Talking about responsibility, it's my responsibility to keep an eye on the time. And we almost reached the end of our episode. And as we open with the same question, we also close with the same question. Maria, what is on the horizon for your scientific work? What to expect? What are you currently really thinking about and working on?
Yeah, that's a great motivator for me to also think about what's on the horizon. But nevertheless, I, as I mentioned earlier, we're currently working on several studies around those topics of open source landscape, how it looks like, whether really it's all about voluntary contribution and like self-motivated user innovation, or there are larger players there. So we kind of like explore the what organization participate in blockchain open source sector. And we also look at how the token funding model, how the availability of free floating token publicly available, how it affects the developers' contributions, as because it presents a new opportunity, new incentive for developers to get engaged with these projects. On a larger scale, I'm constantly thinking about that first question that we started with, about what's new about blockchain technology, what changes it bears for organizations, for communities, and for economic incentive structures.
Thank you so much for your time, and just the best for your future work.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms.
You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.